morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 80 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast.
When Amelia Earhart is lost, a frantic search for her begins immediately. It is the largest naval sea hunt of its kind in history. 63 planes scout the Pacific. The coordinated search also includes more than a dozen surface vessels. In 3 weeks, 250,000 square miles of ocean are carefully scanned. There is no sign of Amelia Earhart.
For 80 years, the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan has remained a mystery. But an ongoing analysis of recently found aircraft wreckage by a specialty lab team from Parker Hannifin Corporation may finally prove where she and her co-pilot disappeared. In episode 21 of the Chasing Earhart podcast, we sit down with John Jeffrey, formerly of Parker Aerospace and current CEO of Hummingbird Technologies, to discuss Amelia Research Inc. and the vital role he played in convincing Parker Aerospace to sponsor one of the most iconic Amelia Earhart research trips of all time. Our guest today on the Chasing Earhart podcast is John Jeffrey, from formerly of Parker Research, Parker Aerospace. John, we're absolutely happy to have you on the podcast. Thanks for coming aboard.
Well, thanks for having me.
So what I like to do is I like to start out by asking all of our guests to tell our listeners, for those who might not be familiar with you or your work or the hypothesis, can you tell us a little bit about your education, your professional background?
Oh, sure. I am a mechanical engineer. I graduated from University of Michigan in like 1980. And then I went on to work at McDonnell Douglas in St. Louis, designed the F-18 aircraft hydraulic and flight control systems. And then from there, I went to Parker Aerospace, which makes hydraulic and flight control systems and components. And I moved up the ranks there and became director of innovation and technology eventually. I also joined the SAE committee early in my career and moved up the ranks to become chairman of SAE A6 that does all the standards for hydraulics and flight controls that are flying out commercially and in the military.
And it's a very unique background. Can you tell us, and the reason why I ask this question is because everybody gives a very neat answer every time I ask it. How did Amelia Earhart enter your life?
Well, I've always known about Amelia and fascinated by her, but it really didn't start until about 3 years ago. My brother called me up and said, hey, remember my buddy Mike? He was on the Raising of the Titanic and a bunch of other famous things, and he's been filmed before on those, but
Mike Harris, right, you're talking about?
Mike Harris, yeah. So I said, yeah, I remember Mike. And I said, why? He said, well, he thinks he knows where Amelia Earhart is. I said, yeah, she's lost at sea, everybody knows that. And he said, no, he's got a whole new story. So, and he wants to do an expedition, and he wants to know if you could ask your company if they would want to sponsor such a thing. I said, well, I doubt it. They're a pretty conservative company. So he pestered me some more and sent me a presentation of things that Mike Harris has done over the last 30 years investigating this. And I was like blown away. I could not believe what I was reading, and didn't realize that there were people out there that had done a lot of work. So I put together a presentation to the top management at Parker Hannifin, went straight to the CEO and asked them if they would be interested in sponsoring an expedition. And they said, yeah, that would, well, they didn't say yeah. They said, well, I don't know. Did she have any Parker parts on her airplane? I said, I don't know. So I had to do some digging. I went back to Mike Harris and asked that same question. He pointed me to a guy named Jim Hayton, who is expert in restored airplanes and old airplanes, and I called him up and said, "Hey, do you have any information about what kind of parts might have been on her airplane?" He goes, "I just happen to have a bill of material that from when her airplane was refurbished and put in extra fuel tanks and things to go on the flight." So he sent me over the bill of material, and lo and behold, there were Parker parts that are on her airplanes, and fuel gauges and fuel fittings, that sort of thing.
That must have blown you away when you saw that, you know, your CEO says, "Hey, if you can find out if there is, then you get that." It must have felt like to you it was meant to be that you guys got involved in this.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I had heard previously that Parker had parts on Charles Lindbergh's airplane, which was previous to that. So there was a good chance probably they had parts on her airplane. But so I called back and told them the news, and they were very excited. And but they said, "You know what? It would be really nice if we could donate, you know, money to a non-charitable organization, because we could do it through our Parker Foundation." So my brother and I looked into it, and my brother actually put together Amelia Research Inc. and named Mike Harris as the head of it. And so we created a charitable organization, and then Parker was able to get us the money.
So, I mean, you came into this almost from a, you know, it's interesting. It's like every time I ask that question, it's always unique. But you came into this really from like a business standpoint at the beginning. I mean, you kind of lobbied and petitioned, you know, your company to do this. And then this kind of sent you down the path of kind of getting more deeply involved. How was that for you as far as that's concerned, like petitioning your company, talking to your CEO, and kind of coming into this in a different manner than most folks and researchers have? I mean, that's very unique.
Yeah. So having no background on this, I was completely innocent on everything, but it was very interesting to see how fast we could make that happen. We were able to get this money within like 3 weeks, which I've never seen anything from a business standpoint happen that fast in the aerospace world. So that was exciting. And Mike Harris put together the trip for everybody. He, with the money that was sent into this account, he was able to buy tickets for getting everybody there, and a ship to live on, and he also hired a company that geophysicists, so that they could bring special equipment to detect metal underground.
So, I mean, you know, it's reading over your PowerPoint presentation and some of the information on you. I mean, it doesn't seem all that different from a lot of folks who really, when they were pulled into this, you know, this search for Amelia Earhart in multiple facets, everybody kind of seemed to accept the idea that she simply crashed and sank. And then that's kind of what happened. That was the United States government's official stance on it. And, you know, that was kind of all the official word. What was it that really kind of shifted you to kind of get so involved as you did, and to petition your company and to kind of get deeper involved? What was it about, you know, what you saw and what you read that just convinced you that this is, you know, much more likely scenario of what happened to her?
Yeah, so what I saw was that Mike had interviewed a bunch of people back in the mid-80s on the Marshall Islands, and there was 35-slide presentation that he sent me. So in reading through it, one interview after another, and then Rich Martini, who did a documentary, it was also in this in this presentation, of the U.S. Marines, who I think are very credible people, and having landed on Saipan and finding her airplane and other artifacts of her on the island, reading about that, it just made a lot more sense to me than having her disappeared at sea, because I knew she was a smart person, had a great navigator with her, and the idea of her just not being able to find some place to land just didn't ever seem like it was the right answer.
So let's dive in a little bit here. Obviously the heart and soul of this particular hypothesis, which is known as the Japanese capture hypothesis in multiple venues and facets, has to do with the fact that, you know, Amelia Earhart was in fact involved with the United States government, at least on this trip, in some way, shape, or form. We all know publicly that she was really good friends with FDR and even better friends with Eleanor, and, you know, they had that tight-knit relationship. Right. How do you think, just from all your research and your personal experience, what is your opinion on how Amelia Earhart got herself tied up in this situation and with the world flight and then involvement with the U.S. government to do ultimately what she was supposed to be doing?
Well, I think originally she got tied up in it by marrying George Putnam. He was promoting her, and I think when she took off out of Hawaii on her first attempt around the world and crashed her plane, and the plane needed to get fixed again before she could try it again, that's where the government got involved, because George Putnam, I believe, went and solicited FDR to provide the funds to fix her airplane. And in exchange for that, they put two reconnaissance cameras on her airplanes. Lockheed engineer is stated he put two reconnaissance cameras on her airplane. And she was asked to fly over, when she was flying over the Pacific, to take pictures of anything interesting that she saw along the way. And I also believe she was sworn into the Army Air Corps, and there's photos of that. And then this became more of a military operation than a commercial one, where they moved her airplane over to March Field here in California, and went over a lot of briefings with her at the field there. That information that I never knew about before was all in that presentation I saw, and that really helped convince me that it wasn't just a casual thing here.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned March Field. Our project was based out of the Inland Empire Riverside area when we first started for phase one, and we'll be going back to some people at March Field want to actually speak with us about the potential meetings that Ms. Earhart had at the March Air Force Base. What I wanted to ask you, and I don't think I've asked anybody this question yet, but, the flight obviously is supposed to go a different direction, and from west to east originally. And then she, of course, ground loops. We all know about that ground loop incident. You just touched on it earlier. All of a sudden, they're out of money at this point, Earhart and Putnam. They've kind of mortgaged their life for this flight to make this happen. But they got no more money. So the U.S. government essentially steps in and kind of foots the bill for it. But it's been widely speculated that there was like 11 branches of the government that kind of came together to make this happen for her, that they got involved in this project. And they put the plane in a hangar. A special crew came in, and you kind of alluded to some gentleman putting some cameras in the plane itself. What I want to know, and I don't think I've ever asked this question of any guest yet, do you think that she originally was asked by FDR to do this and initially maybe declined, and then when the ground loop incident occurred, they kind of had no choice but to kind of come back to the U.S. government to petition to have some help, and then they said, well, we'll help you, but we need to do it our way, and this is what you're going to do for us so we can help you? Do you think it was, I don't want to say a strong arm attempt or anything by the U.S. government, but do you think it was kind of like, well, we kind of have no choice now, we have to go by what they want to do?
I don't know if they petitioned her originally on her first flight or not. I've heard nothing about that. But I think that there was probably some attempt to strong arm her into this a little bit. I did hear, and I don't have any record of where this came from, that she said to a girlfriend, "Imagine me a spy." I don't know where that came from, but I think she sounded to me like she was definitely aware of what she was doing, and that being sworn in and knowing that she had cameras on her airplane, and that she was at a airbase, just seems to me that she probably knew she was on a mission.
Yeah, you know, there's a photo, you have it in your PowerPoint presentation of her being sworn in. There's a photo of this.
Right.
That's you know, a lot of folks within the Earhart community probably know about the photo pretty well, but a lot of folks that are outside that community or just common folks don't know about it. What I wanted to talk about now is kind of her flight path, and I want to get into the hypothesis a little bit. So take me on this flight path and tell our listeners, you know, what exactly your guys' kind of thought process is and what your hypothesis is regarding what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan.
And I'm not too much of an expert in this area. There are a lot of people that have hypothesized things about the flight path. The only things that stuck in my mind of all the things that I've heard is that she was in, she took off from Ley, New Guinea and was going to Holland Island, and that there was a wind that would tend to push her towards the north of Howland Island. And the other thing I heard was that there was cloud cover north and east of Howland Island all the way to Hawaii. Basically, it was the skies were covered with clouds over there, but nothing south and west of there. So I understand that she reported at one point that she was in the clouds and that she was dipping below to try to see, find land, which makes me tend to believe she was north and east of Holland Island. The other thing I heard is that she was instructed that if she didn't find Holland Island, that she should turn back due west and try to find the Gilbert Islands and land there if she could. Having been north of the Holland Islands, I think when she turned due west, she was more likely to hit the Marshall Islands. That's the thing that makes the most sense to me.
Do we know what the original plan was? Have you guys speculated on that? Have you, as far as the research and your team and what you guys have gone through, what was the original plan? Obviously, they didn't plan for her to get captured, but you know, they planned for her to take these reconnaissance photos and to kind of safely make it back home. Was there an original plan as far as you guys know and as far as your research has pointed you to?
I don't know the original plan in terms of getting photos back to the United States. Don't know anything about that. I think the original plan was to make it safely to Howland and safely to next stop would have been Hawaii and then back to the continental U.S. But not being able to find Howland. And I guess the other thing that I've heard is that neither she nor Fred Noonan knew Morse code and that the Coast Guard wasn't alerted of this fact because her previous co-pilot did know Morse code. And so communicating that way, I guess, didn't become an option as well.
Yeah, I often wonder if Manning was aboard the plane, if we wouldn't even be here right now. You know, they would have had a much better opportunity to get out and to get communication out there. So it's kind of a tragedy in and of itself that he wasn't able to be on board that plane.
Right.
So, you know, I want to ask you about Fred, cause I always wonder, like, do you think Fred, I mean, obviously he, I don't know, first of all, did he know? I mean, was Fred involved in, I mean, sometimes people can kind of be in the know and not be in the know. Was Fred involved? Do you think he agreed with it? And was he just kind of, I'll go along with whatever you want to do, Amelia, kind of deal, or what do you think his option?
I don't know if he knew about that end of it or not. I have no idea. He was an excellent navigator in the Pacifics, had been all over that area before. So he was a real a good navigator, I guess.
So I want to highlight some of the Marines because, you know, you have that in your presentation and a lot of folks, you know, these names are really big. And I'm going to kind of utilize your presentation to kind of talk about some of these gentlemen. Robert Wallach is a real famous one. He was, you know, he was a part of the invasion on Saipan in 1944. He's the one that found the safe that blew open the safe and kind of famously said, I'm going to be a rich guy. Took off with this briefcase rather. And turns out you know, he cracks this thing open and it's Amelia Earhart stuff and it's bone dry. There's no, you know, and they were, I mean, just like you and everybody else think it, they were under the impression that, hey, didn't she crash and sink in the ocean? Like, why, if she crashed and sank, why is her stuff bone dry?
Right.
And then Julia's neighbors, who was the wire operator who decoded the message that said famously Amelia's plane has been found at Acelito Airfield. This is a guy, you know, this is all he did for the military. I mean, this was his wheelhouse. This was his specialty. You know, all he did was was a wire operator and decoded messages. These are guys, like you mentioned, are very honorable men. They're young. They're all very young. But these are the kind of guys that, and not these gentlemen in particular, but men of that time would lie about their age and sign up for the military to serve their country. I mean, they were honorable men.
Right.
There's over 200 eyewitnesses. I know, you know, in a court of law, eyewitness testimony is kind of on the fence as far as credibility is concerned. But when you have over 200 people that are in different areas of the Marshall Islands that all say the same thing, we just interviewed John Hagedorn a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you know, unless 200 people get together to kind of or have a psychic connection over the course of, you know, all this time, it's really difficult to kind of just throw all that out and discredit it. Right. What is your take on all the, you know, all the eyewitness, this immense amount of eyewitness testimony throughout the Marshall Islands and throughout the U.S. military, including Admiral Nimitz, who Nimitz is about as good and respectable as you can possibly get?
Well, that's what convinced me when I received the presentation. It blew me away that there were so many people involved from different areas of the world, including, you know, ham operator in the U.S. picking up her message and kind of saying some of the same things. How are all these people, you know, saying the same things and at different points in the world and conversations, and we not believing them? You know, Julius Neighbors, he was asked to guard the hangar with the Amelia's airplane in it, and was there to see it being destroyed as well, and probably sits underneath the Saipan International runway at this moment. But I mean, all that information and all those eyewitnesses, the Japanese had to enlist a lot of Marshallese people to drag her airplane across from the reef to the lagoon side to load it onto the Koshu. And then people that looked after Amelia and Fred of their injuries, and you know, the list goes on and people in Saipan in the prison that attended to them, changed their sheets and brought food and such. And one woman still alive in San Francisco that says she attended to them in the prison. So yeah.
Yeah, she was. That was the lady that was featured on the Lost Evidence documentary, right? That they went.
That's right.
You know, it's interesting, and you know, I'm not sure what your feeling is on this next question, but I'd like to ask it anyway. I mean, there seems to be like a contrast of the Japanese people in the Marshall Islands seem to really love Amelia. They were kind of fans of Amelia Earhart. This is a worldwide celebrity. She was America's sweetheart at the time, And you know, in 1987, they released the commemorative stamps. I mean, they were celebrating the fact that she was here. It's just, Mike Harris was telling us, it's just common knowledge. It's just as if you know your car's parked outside, you knew Amelia Earhart was here. It was very straightforward. But the Japanese government and maybe the Japanese military, on the other hand, felt differently about her because maybe they found the cameras, maybe they didn't. We don't really know. That's kind of speculation. But was there, in fact, a contrast, do you think, between, you know, the Japanese people and the people that inhabited, you know, the natives on that island inhabited and the people that were running the island as far as the government? Do you think that how do you think the Japanese people felt about all these witnesses? How do you think they felt about seeing her? Do you think there was a contrast there between them and the government and their military that was there?
I don't know how they felt, but I think they found the airplane and Amelia and Fred. And at first they probably didn't know who they were, but I think when they heard on the airwaves, all the hoopla going on about Amelia lost at sea. And I think even the U.S. asked the Japanese if they would help find her. I think they figured out what they had. And at that point, became very different in terms of making sure that they were probably worried about what they should do with her. And the contrast between them and the Marshallese people, I think the Marshallese people had no idea who these people were and why there was such a fuss about it, but they soon realized what was happening as well.
I want to touch very briefly on the expedition artifacts and some of the parts that you guys have found on your trips and subsequent trips over there to the Marshall Islands. And we're going to talk with Dick Spink actually on the 21st. And so we'll kind of really dive in with him on the stuff that they found and all that good stuff. But what's your thoughts and your opinion on the trim piece for the wheel well trim piece and the dust cover and all these things that you guys have found? I mean, is it? I guess my question is, as someone who kind of helped finance and get sponsorship and everything, what does it do in your mind for the hypothesis and the work you guys are doing? Is that a morale booster? I imagine it would be in a big way when you guys find this stuff.
Yeah, it was very exciting to find these pieces. At first, we didn't know what they were until we brought them back to the United States. We went to the island, and every day we went off the ship with a tender, went in onto Endricken Island and with metal detectors and covered that island pretty well. We did grids, and this stuff was found 15 to 18 inches underneath the soil. So we had to dig quite a bit down in order to find this stuff after the metal detectors went off. Like the metal trim piece for the wheel well, we didn't know it was anything until we brought it back and looked at it against a airplane that was restored, a Lockheed Electra airplane that was restored in the state of Washington. We went up and held it up, and it was an exact shape, and the rolled edge is a hand rolled edge on that. That was really exciting when that happened. And did metallurgical work on it, both with Parker and with Alcoa. I had a friend at Alcoa, and he got the CTO of Alcoa to authorize testing of this artifacts. And while we couldn't prove that the artifacts were from her airplane, we did able to prove that the metal was consistent with the metal in the 1930s. And the hand rolled edge, they went to machine rolled edges in the 40s. So having a piece with a hand rolled edge was a really great find.
I want to move on a little bit to getting the artifacts out of the Marshall Islands, and you were really instrumental in that and kind of orchestrating that. I think that kind of plays into your background, and it's definitely to your credit. How did that process go for you, and what was your approach to that and as far as negotiation and with the Marshals? And I know it's very kind of a different situation over there. How did that work for you? What did you have to go through for that?
Well, it was a team effort. We all worked on it, but we all met with the president, Loyak, of the Marshall Islands at that time before we went out and asked permission, and the senators from that atoll gave us permission to search the island. And then we went to the woman that owned the island, and we met with her, and she gave us permission. So we knew that we were in solid ground before we found anything. So we brought the artifacts back to Majuro and to the Capitol and showed all of the president and senators what we had found, went through everything. We went to the ministry that handles artifacts and set up a document, and we all signed it off, and then we're able to take these artifacts to the United States.
And I want to ask you to speculate a little bit here, if you can. Tell me a little bit about what you think will happen if, let's hypothetically say, okay, you guys, on your next trip over there, whether it's, Dick and Les or, whoever's over there, somebody finds the plane or some kind of concrete evidence that the plane is there, or a large piece of the plane, whatever, you know, take your pick, whatever you'd like. Right. What do you do at that point as far as negotiating that? And how does, you know, speaking of someone that has kind of dealt with the Republic of the Marshall Islands, how does the U.S. kind of, you know, work with that country to, you know, maybe retrieve the plane, get permission to get the plane, to extract the plane and to get it back to the United States, or, you know, whether it's a, you know, let's say they find bones or whatever the case is. Right. How does that work from your standpoint, do you think? What do you guys have to do? How does that kick in?
Well, we think the plane and the bones would be on Saipan. The accounts from the U.S. Marines were that they pushed the plane into the end of the runway along with all the other airplanes that they were that had been destroyed there. You know, we think that the plane and evidence of Amelia or Fred would be on Saipan, and that the, you know, airplane was destroyed there and pushed off the end of the runway and then buried over, and eventually the Saipan International Airport runways have been paved over it. So getting at the airplane might be difficult at this point. Not impossible. If there was something discovered, we'd have to probably work with the Saipan government, and we'd want to try to bring them back to the U.S. to do some studies on it. And if it's bones, perhaps get DNA evidence from Amelia's relatives that have the same DNA. So we would probably do that.
So let's move on to what's become known as the photo. That's basically all that people talk. That's where they refer to it as. Les Kinney discovers this photo in the National Archives. Of course, it's kind of like the crown jewel of the Lost Evidence documentary. And then, you know, there's controversy around the photo. We won't get too much into that right now, but it's being investigated on multiple fronts. I know Les, last time I spoke with him, was kind of, they went back out to Saipan to do some further investigation and kind of corroborate the photo and get all that information that they could. What was your first reaction when you saw that photo? And what does that photo, basically saying that it's real, we're basically going to assume that it is in fact confirmed to be an accurate photo. What does that do for you guys and for the work that you've been doing and on this hypothesis for so long? I mean, does that give you guys a sense of vindication for kind of, you know, everything you guys have gone through and some of the stuff that, you know, you guys have had to deal with?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't even know about the photo until, I knew of the photo maybe a year ago, but they were keeping it very quiet. So I never saw the actual photo until it came out on the History Channel. And when I saw it, I was like, oh my goodness, that is incredible. The likeness of, even seeing the back of Amelia and the image of Fred there that was shown, it just sent chills down my spine. I just really felt that was something that was corroborating the whole thing, that they were brought to Jaluit to treat their injuries, and Bilimon Amaron, who was the doctor on Jaluit that went on to the Koshu to treat Fred Noonan's injuries. It was sitting there for a little while. So I'd love to find out who took the photograph. that's interesting that it appears.
Yeah, that is the $64,000 question. Who took that photo and what became of that person that took that photo? That would be interesting to find out.
Right.
So I want to wrap up with you here, but I do want to ask you a couple final questions. The next question I'm going to ask you simply is just, what's next for you guys? What is on the radar for you guys? What work is being done currently research-wise? I know you have an awful lot of folks that are involved, a lot of real talented folks that are involved in your work and what you guys are doing. What's up? What's next with you guys?
Yeah, so being the newcomer, I and bringing the financial to this, I'm not as involved with what's going on with the next steps as Les and Dick and Mike Harris, but I do keep in touch with them on a regular basis. And I did give a presentation this past week at a SAE Aerotech conference, and afterwards a woman came up to me and told me about a place in Japan to go looking for evidence. So I've written Les a letter to see if he'd be interested in going to this new location for finding evidence of records that were in the 1930s. But it sounds like those guys are doing some great work still, and I'll be interested, as everybody else, to see what comes up next.
John, one final question before we wrap up our interview. It's a question I ask every guest on Chasing Earhart. It's been 80 years, obviously everybody knows, since the disappearance of Amelia and Fred. The country, the world is still fascinated by this case. Can I ask you to tell our listeners what you personally believe is Amelia Earhart's impact and her legacy 80 years after she disappeared?
She's a tremendous American hero, and that's my entire interest for pursuing this. I have made zero money doing this. It's just because I want to see the truth being told about Amelia Earhart and her contribution to she was a true American hero going off, and she got caught up into something and was killed because of it. And I'd like for her to be recognized by the United States as a war hero.
Wow. Okay. We're going to end it on that, 'cause that's about as awesome as it can get right there. John, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. I know you have a lot going on. Thank you so much for coming aboard the Chasing Earhart podcast. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks so much.
I'm Chris Williamson, and you've been listening to the Chasing Earhart podcast. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle @ChasingEarhart. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast.
Join me next week as we sit down with author of East to the Dawn, Susan Butler. Thanks for listening.